calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you on this last day of 2005. Welcome to our program, TomHartman.com. If you want to drop into our live chat room, our toll-free telephone number all across the United States, and around the world, actually. I think most countries can dial into a toll-free number nowadays. 1-866, although it's not toll-free, 1-866-440-8466, 440-THOM. And the first hour here of our Friday program, as always, we have Congressman Bernie Sanders with us. Our Brunch with Bernie segment, Congressman Bernie Sanders, the only independent member of the House of Representatives. I think of him as America's congressman. He's now running for the United States Senate, and I think he will be America's senator, I'll tell you. Bernie.org, B-E-R-N-I-E.org is his website. I highly recommend, strongly recommend you check it out. Bernie Sanders, welcome to the program.
Good to be with you, Tom, and a very, very happy new year to all of the listeners and you and Louise and the family.
Well, thank you, Bernie, and the same to you and your family, and it's so great to have wrapped up this year here with you. Let's take a snapshot, an overview. I know it's almost cliché to do it, but I think that in this case it's probably pretty important to look back at this last year.
It is. It's been a remarkable year in many respects. And sometimes, Tom, I think that what we as politicians or media people do, we focus on the issues of the day, which we have got to do, and interpret that and point out what's going on. But sometimes we forget to take a long view at what's happening and what is happening to ordinary people's lives in America. How are we doing as a country? How is the average person doing? And I think if you look back, there's some real questions that we have to ask ourselves. In America today, worker productivity and technology are exploding. All kinds of good things are happening. Is the average American benefiting from those changes, or to a very significant degree, are all of those positive developments, or much of them, ending up in the hands of the wealthy and the powerful? And I'm afraid that the latter is, in fact, the truth. We have got to ask ourselves why real wages, real inflation accounted for wages today, are substantially lower for American workers than they were 30 years ago. We've got to ask ourselves why family median income in the United States under Bush has gone down for the last 5 years. We've got to ask ourselves why the gap between the rich and the poor is growing wider. There were just some reports that came out recently about the kind of bonuses and executive compensations that these CEOs of large corporations are getting, and they are just extraordinary. These guys are making zillions and zillions of dollars a year. At the same time as they're slashing health care benefits for workers, retiree health care benefits for those people who worked at the companies previously, cutting back on health care for their present workers. Meanwhile, the guys who run the companies are making out like bandits. We're looking at a nation today where 6 million more people have no health insurance than was the case before Bush became president. We're looking at a nation where 5 million people, more people, are in poverty than before Bush became president. And you know, I think our job is to try to ask why that is happening and what kind of policies we need to reverse that. And more importantly than that, we have to have a vision of where we want America to be. It's not good enough just to be critical of the disastrous Bush policies. That's pretty obvious. Where do we want to go? Why are we the only nation in the industrialized world that does not provide health care to all of its people as a right of citizenship? Can we do that? Should healthcare be a profit-making business, or should we run it on a nonprofit basis, making sure that all of our people have quality care? Why is it, when we talk about the need to be competitive in the global economy, that it is getting harder and harder for middle-class families to be able to send their kids to college? Why is that? 30 years ago, you may remember, Tom, that in great universities like the University of California, you know what tuition was, what, 25, 30 years ago? You remember what it was?
It was free.
It was free.
I remember well.
We said to working class kids, low income kids, if you are serious about academia, we are going to open up some of the best universities in the world. City College in New York City, University of California, state colleges all over this country. You're going to be able to get a college degree free because we want, not only for yourself, but for America, to have the best educated population in the world. Where is that dream? Where is it now? People are now, kids are graduating college, I think on average, approximately $20,000 in debt. They can't go into the careers they want to go into. A lot of lower income young people just are choosing not to go to college now.
And now I see in
where is the vision? Where is the dream? We can't afford those things? Give me a break. Of course we can. And you have a president of the United States who says, well, one of my priorities is I want to go to Mars. I want to go back to the moon. Really? When we have more and more people in this country living in poverty, more and more people in this country who are hungry. So I think we really need to focus on a couple of things. Number one, where do we want to go? And number two, how do we get there? And number three, to make people aware that the political process is extraordinarily important. What happens politically is enormously important to every man, woman, and child in this country. And if you don't think it is, and I know a lot of people say, I don't vote, it's all crap, they're all crooks, you know, Congress is a joke, the White House is a joke, I got other things to do with my life to worry about this stuff, but I just want you to ask yourself why it is that the large multinational corporations spend hundreds of millions of dollars on campaign contributions to elect their candidates, while there are why there are lobbyists running all over Washington, D.C. The pharmaceutical industry itself, which gives us by far the highest prices for medicine in the entire world, has something like 800 well-paid lobbyists on Capitol Hill, just the pharmaceutical industry, not to mention the oil companies or the other big industries. Now, why are they so concerned about the political process and millions of Americans, politics doesn't matter? Of course it matters. What happens in Washington, what happens in state capitals all over this country is of extraordinary importance. So we've got to change our political culture so that instead of just talking about the football game or the basketball game or the baseball game, every now and then we want to raise some issues like, why do 46 million Americans not have any health insurance, and yet we have a health care system that spends twice as much per person on health care as any other system throughout the world? Why do we have a trade policy which enables corporate America to send our jobs to China and other low-wage countries so that we are losing industry after industry, good-paying job after good-paying job, the automobile industry? And all that that means to America is now under severe threat. We don't know if it's going to be here 10 or 15 years from now. We're losing white-collar jobs to Russia, to India, to China, so that all of these kids who are learning how to do good work on the computer may not be able to do that because Bill Gates and Microsoft and a lot of these other companies would prefer to do business in India. You know, we better start talking about this issue. We better raise the voter turnout so that working people, low-income people, stand up and start fighting for their rights. We can do extraordinary things in this country. We can wipe out poverty. It's not a utopian dream. We can do it. You can provide good quality education from child care through college. We can do that. We can have health care for all of our people. We can create decent-paying jobs for our kids. We can protect family farmers in America. These are not utopian visions. We can do it if we sit down and roll up our sleeves and say, you know what, let's make the government of the United States, let's make state government work for all of the people, not just the wealthy and the powerful who buy politicians and influence legislation through their campaign contributions. So I think, you know, that's what I think we have got to be thinking about as we enter 2006.
And yet in the meantime, you mentioned, for example, college and the University of California used to be free before Ronald Reagan got a hold of it. And now in this piece of legislation that just passed Congress, the average student loan over the course of the student loan is going to cost $5,600 more for the average student who is borrowing money. This from, you know, courtesy of the Republican Party.
JP?
Bernie?
I've been cut off the radio there, so.
I think he thinks he got dropped.
Hello?
So, hey, Bernie, you still there? Bernie apparently can't hear me, Alex. Whatever you did earlier so that I could talk to Bernie, you can't hear me. Yeah, Bernie.
Okay, good.
Yeah, as I was saying, in addition to this, and we've got to go to a break in just a second here, now we have this legislation that says over the lifetime of a student loan, it's going to cost $5,600 more because of this budget reconciliation that just happened.
Absolutely. Tax breaks for millionaires and billionaires, which is what they'll be proposing when we get back, cuts in education. You're absolutely right.
Incredible. It's 16 minutes past the hour. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Congressman Bernie Sanders with us. Bernie.org, his website. Our toll-free number, 866-440-8466. Give us a call. Bernie would like to talk with you. I'll be right back.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Now I'm a union man, amazed at what I am. I say what I think, that the company stinks. Yes, I'm a union man.
And welcome back, my friends. The place where despair is not an option. You got to get active. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. Our Brunch with Bernie segment. Bernie Sanders with us. Bernie.org, his website. Congressman Bernie Sanders, the only independent member of the House of Representatives running to be, as Jim Jeffords retires, the only independent member of the United States Senate. Hopefully we can say that a year from now. Bernie, welcome back to the program.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Bernie, it's we're going to go to the phone lines here in just a second, but point of privilege as the talk show host, a question for you. It seems to me that with Fox's war on Christmas and all the hysteria around gay marriage or whatever, I mean, you have flag burning, and pull your topic out of the out of the bin, that these are all just massive distractions from the stuff that you've been talking about.
I think that's exactly right, and that's what its function is about. If you look at Fox, if you look at these other right-wing guys, there is not, and you look at the President of the United States, we have a major health care crisis. No one denies that. Healthcare system is disintegrating. More and more people uninsured, more and more people underinsured, cost of health care soaring, cutbacks in Medicaid. There should be, at the very least, an honest debate on this issue. What does the President have to say? Virtually nothing. Virtually nothing.
Well, neither does ABC, NBC, CBS,
That's
MSNBC,
right.
et cetera.
So you get the real issue here, it seems to me, is the massive effort on the part of the right wing not to debate the issues because they got nothing to say. Yeah. It's to deflect attention away from the real issues, health care, the economy and the decline of the standard of living of the middle class, the environmental degradation that we're seeing, the lack of opportunity for many of our young people. You deflect attention away from those issues. You've got nothing to say, and you come up with these absurd ideas. There is a war going on against Christmas. Gay people are taking over our schools. Abortion is the most important issue facing humanity. And all of those efforts, successfully to some degree, I must say, deflect attention away from a debate on the real issue as to how we create a good standard of living for all of our people.
Well said. 23 minutes past the hour, we're talking with Congressman Bernie Sanders. This is our Brunch with Bernie segment here on the Tom Hartman program. Our number toll-free across the United States, 866-440-8466. And, of course, if you want to drop into our live chat room, go to tomhartman.com. Gary in Gig Harbor, Washington, you're live with Congressman Sanders. Hey, Gary.
Hi, Mr. Hartman. Thanks a lot for your savvy, your perspicacity on political thought and historical. It's enlightened a lot of us. I was a teacher in the third largest district in the country, UTLA of Los Angeles, went on strike 8 weeks, 6 weeks. School board during those 30 years never offered us more than 1.2% in rate. Our union got us 4.8% to 8% when our contract ended. Once we got a 10% due to our union, but it lasted 1 year, then they took it away. My second point in 63, took an econ class and read a book, Rich Nations, Poor Nations. And the writer said as the gap between the rich and the middle class and the poor classes widens, social discontent, strikes, then rebellion. The last chapter, she said, it will happen in the United States.
So is there, Gary, is there a question for Bernie Sanders in there?
No, I just wanted to make a point. Well, but my last point is that the president of Venezuela said that he would contribute $10 million for the heating costs. I wonder if he did. He also mentioned that he would nationalize the oil companies, and if he does and gives back to his people, then I think he'll be one of the most altruistic leaders of our time.
Okay.
That's all I wanted to say.
Gary, thank you. Thank you much. Bernie, you want to bounce off any of that, or should we go to the next caller? Okay. Dave in Eureka, California. You're live with Bernie Sanders.
Good morning, gentlemen. I wanted to take a stab at the question you're posing there, Bernie, as to why so much of the wealth of the nation is shifting from the working people into the pockets of the very richest folks. And I'm convinced it has nothing to do with bungling or incompetence. It's a very much a willful plan. The base, as he calls them, are these very haves and have-mores, and that they are not driven by any regard for the amount of people that they are harming in the process. That is to say, they really don't, it is not troubling them that many people are going to end up hungry, without insurance, without health care, because what they will have is this millions of people competing for low-wage jobs without any benefits, and that will benefit the very greediest and very richest.
That's
it's
right.
Terrible, terrible government we've got in place right now.
It's a terrible
Thank
situation,
you,
and it's a terrible culture by which we say, hey, no problem that CEOs can make a few $100 million over a 3 or 4 year period while they're cutting back on the benefits of their workers and moving their jobs. But in fact, we look up to those people. They're our heroes. Rather than being people who should be ashamed of themselves. We sometimes call ourselves a religious country, but I sometimes think that the most important religion that exists is greed. These guys want more and more and more. Nobody objects to somebody who works hard, comes up with ideas, starts a business, making money. Nobody objects to that. But the current gap between the rich and the poor and the unfair distribution of wealth in America in this country right now is becoming scandalous.
Well, and beyond being unfair, it's not good for democracy.
And it's not good.
I mean, you know, read History 101. It's well said. We're talking with Congressman Bernie Sanders. Brunch with Bernie. Our telephone number, 866-440-8466, this last Friday of the year. We'll be right back. Tom, the Tom Hartman Radio Program.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Happy New Year! Happy New Year! May we all have a nation now and then. Of the world where every neighbor is a friend.
And welcome back, my friends. Yes, Happy New Year, and may we all have a mission. 34 minutes after the hour, 25 minutes before the hour. This is there's a statistic recently in the newspaper, 1 in 10 teenagers depressed. I got to tell you, historically, if you go back and read the literature psychology, one of the most effective remedies for depression is to get active, to have a mission, to have a purpose. And I think taking back America and providing democracy to the United States is one of the most noble missions you can have, and it certainly has been at the core of Bernie Sanders' work throughout his political life. Bernie Sanders with us, Congressman Bernie Sanders. Bernie.org, his website, it's our Brunch with Bernie segment, our telephone number, 1-866-440-8466. And Rob in Beach City, Ohio, you are on the air and live with Bernie Sanders. Hey,
Mr.
Rob.
Sorry, Tom. Congressman Sanders, I'd like to take the time here to thank you for being just such a honest individual. It's real rare these days to run into somebody like you.
Thank you very much, Rob.
Well, thank you. And thank you, Mr. Hartman, for such a wonderful show.
My pleasure, Rob. Did you have a question, or did you
say
thanks?
I just wanted to make a comment.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks for your time.
Okay, I appreciate it. Thank you very
much.
Joel in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. You're live and on the air. Hey, Joel.
Hey. There was a report on ABC a couple weeks ago, and it was Peter Jennings' last documentary, hour-long report. And it was about the problems with health care in this country. And the conclusion was that it's the fault of the American people.
Blame the victims.
Yeah, blame the victims. In other words, we asked for too much. We asked for too many tests, and you know, we spend too much money. So that's the problem. Didn't even, you know, they considered a bunch of different things, but that's what they came up with. So, ABC did cover it, and they made it worse.
Yeah.
Well, I think it is.
Thanks,
it Joel. Joel, if you just think back and try to recall how many TV programs you have seen which compared the American system, which is disintegrating, with systems all over the world. And there's no, I should be clear, there's no perfect system, whether it's Canada or Europe. Every country has its problems, and I think that's inevitable in healthcare. Things are always changing. There are always problems. But if you look at the American non-system, what we should understand is that with 46 million people uninsured, we still spend twice as much per capita on healthcare as any other nation on earth, and nobody, but nobody can deny that this is the most wasteful and bureaucratic and unfair healthcare system in the entire world. It is not the American people's fault. Clearly, it is a system that needs fundamental overhaul.
Well said. Steve in Cleveland, Ohio, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Hello.
Steve, you are on the air.
I'm on the air now?
You are. Listen to your telephone.
Yeah, my
radio.
Name is Steve. I live in Cleveland, Ohio. Tom, I listened to your show. I just got serious the last few months. I love your show, and I love the Channel 146 here.
Thank you.
I appreciate what you guys are saying. I come from the coal fields of Pennsylvania. My grandparents fought for the unions. They were there when they brought the Yellow Dogs in on horseback to shoot up the towns to frighten the ethnics out of forming the United Mine Workers Union. I went to work in a record business in 1962. I rose through the ranks. I ended up working for a guy named Clive Davis, who is still an industry legend. I have a record company called Cleveland International Records. Our biggest record was a group called Meatloaf. We had an album called Bat Out of Hell.
Mm-hmm.
Sold
I remember
over 40 million records.
Mm-hmm.
My point is this. I've been in the record business 40 years. I've had two lawsuits. In 1977, when I started my company, I signed an 82-page contract, me and a couple of partners. I gave them the ownership of the master recordings in return for a royalty and my logo on each record. I had to sue them to get either one. So my point is these corporations are allowed to get away with robbing. I mean, they literally are criminals in these contracts that are one-sided that they have no intention of ever upholding their end of the bargain. They take what they want from you, and you have to sue. I just completed a 5-year lawsuit in federal court in Cleveland and won a unanimous jury verdict. 9 members agreed with my side. And now these guys are appealing it.
Yeah, well, one of the
first thing I die or go broke fighting
right.
them.
Well, here's the point. I mean, obviously, I don't know
good
if
point,
Tom
Steve.
Knows anything about your particular case, but
yeah, I don't.
What you see is if you are a regular individual with normal financial resources, how do you take on in a legal battle a corporation which has unlimited pockets, who can appeal and appeal and appeal, can delay? So justice increasingly in America falls with those who have the money to buy justice, and it is, in fact, a very serious problem.
Jessica in Lansing, Michigan, my old hometown. Hey, Jessica, you're live with Congressman Bernie Sanders.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yep. Yes.
Yeah, thanks for the show. I wanted to talk about student loans. You had mentioned some of the changes
yep.
they've been making with that. I have to admit that I was in default on a student loan, so it was turned over to a collection agency, and I understand that. I don't have an objection to that. I think that was, fair. But in order to get out of collection status, they garnish my wages, and I have to make both that garnishment payment plus an extra payment, which amounts to about like 25% of my income, basically, and is really kind of impossible for me to pay that much. So that means that I have to stay in, and you have to do that 12 payments. You have to do it for a whole year, make double payments. And so what they do in addition to that is they add 25% of the total amount of the loan. They add that on top as a collection fee, not interest, a collection fee. So my loan went up from from whatever it was to suddenly $44,000. And it just I can imagine myself being sort of in hock to that for the rest of my life. And the Michigan Guarantee Agency isn't helpful in terms of, you know, trying to help me take care of that.
Well, Jessica,
I was just thinking,
thank
you know, there ought to be some way that we can sort of rehabilitate our credit if we've made a mistake like that.
Well, I'm afraid that we're moving on the Republican leadership in Congress in exactly the wrong direction with a disastrous bankruptcy bill, which is going to hit working people even harder than was previously the case. But you just, you know, articulated in your personal story what is happening to millions of people, and that is, here is an instance where somebody doesn't have a lot of money. You go to college, you're in debt, you have financial problems, and what happens is, because you have financial problems, you can't pay, you end up much, much in even worse shape and having to pay off a lot more, which takes us to the whole issue of lending in America and the fact that people who are listening to the show are sometimes paying 25% interest rates on their credit cards, and on it goes. So, Jessica, you're absolutely right. What is going on is an outrage. Working people who are having financial problems, paying off their loans, should not be forced to go even deeper into hock, deeper into financial trouble, forced into bankruptcy. It's a pretty crazy and unfair system, which benefits the lenders, obviously, and not working people.
Earl in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, you're on the air with Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, Congressman Sanders, Tom, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
Question here is, what did the Republicans find out to convince middle America that they're right? I mean, that, you know, we send you a $300 check, and all of a sudden, you know, we have the answers. I mean,
well, I
talk to the average guy. I'm a bartender. I talk to people all day from all stratas. And they, even the people who are what I consider working guys, feel that they're right. It's like, you know, I don't know what they did to convince everybody.
Well, what they do, a lot of things. So Tom and I, you know, started the discussion talking just about this issue, and I think it's a deflection away from the real issues facing people. It's a media that does not talk about alternatives and options. I think what goes on is we focus on issues like gay marriage, we focus on abortion, we focus on guns, rather than the reason why people are working longer hours for low wages, why when you talk about tax breaks, Earl, these people should know that as a result of these tax breaks, the deficit and the national debt is going up and up and up. We now, as a nation, have an $8 trillion national debt, which means that every man, woman, and child owes over $27,000. Yeah, people may have gotten small tax breaks, but half of the tax breaks went to the wealthiest 1%. And this is the kind of discussion that we've got to have. Unfortunately, a lot of people are not hearing those points of view.
And these aren't even really tax breaks, are they, Bernie? I mean, because my children and grandchildren are going to have to pay off this money that is being borrowed in their name to hand these large checks or to reduce the tax payments from
huge
millionaires and billionaires.
Huge tax breaks to billionaires so that your kids and grandchildren will then have to pay them off in years to come. I mean, that is just an outrage.
Yeah, and how can they call them tax breaks? I just don't get it. I mean,
loans from our grandchildren to millionaires is what
yeah.
they are.
Yeah, in my opinion, just very clearly. We're going to come back to your phone calls and just say we're going to go to a break here in just a moment. But these are the issues of our times, Bernie. It's just how they can get us away from the economics of it, because the survival of democracy requires a strong and vibrant middle class.
Yeah.
And they're ripping it apart. They are just ripping it apart. It's 45 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program here. Our Brunch with Bernie segment. Congressman Bernie Sanders with us. Our phone number, 866-440-8466. We'll be back with your calls right after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Should old acquaintance be forgot?
And welcome back, my friends. 9.5 minutes before the hour on the last Friday of 2005. TGIF, happy Friday, happy end of the year, Shabbat Shalom, whatever's appropriate for you. Hope you're having a great day. Hope you have a very safe and healthy and happy
New Year's celebration. We're talking with Congressman Bernie Sanders. This is our Brunch with Bernie segment. Bernie.org, his website. Louie in Orlando, Florida. You are on the air with Congressman Bernie Sanders. Louie, welcome to the program.
Hey, thank you, Congressman, and thank you, Tom, for having me on the show. I just want to say in 2006, my resolution is to elect the ABR party, anyone but Republicans, to Congress. And my question to Bernie is, what are you going to do, or I'm asking for your help, Ellie, actually, to help us progressives in the field. I'm a registered Democrat. I lean for the Democratic Party, but I'll vote for anyone that's pro-labor and wants to bring some controls to our border and repeal NAFTA. What platforms can we put out there that will defeat the Republicans in 2006? Thank you.
Thank you, Louie.
Well, Louie, I think, as Tom and I have been talking about all afternoon here, is I think if we stay on the basic issues that impact the real lives of real people, I think we win. And I think those are, how are you doing economically? Is your income going up? Well, if so, you're really out of the mainstream because the vast majority of the people are working longer hours for low wages. How's your health care situation? How's your pension situation? What do you think about the environment? What do you think about the war in Iraq? I think if we stay on the basic issues impacting the real lives of average Americans, get them to think about that, propose progressive ideas which say that public policy should not just be benefiting the wealthy and large corporations, such as trade policies that you've mentioned, but that we should be developing policies that benefit the middle class, working people, lower income people. If we focus on those issues, I think, Louis, we win big time.
Ted in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, you're on the air with Bernie Sanders.
Yes, good afternoon, gentlemen, and Happy New Year.
Thank you.
You know, it just strikes me as kind of duplistic for the Republicans. The conservative wing always votes for social agenda, and what's actually happened is that the establishment wing is using the conservative wing as a veneer for populist vote, and basically the establishment wing is running everything. Big money is running everything, and they always fall on the social issues. But it's the establishment wing that's really running the Republican Party.
I think you make a very good point. Certainly the money is coming from large multinational corporations and these big CEOs. And if you think these CEOs, in most cases, stay up nights worrying about abortion, if their wives and their daughters don't have abortions, you'd be very, very wrong. If you think that many of them are intolerant to gays or don't have gay people who are friends or working for them, you would be wrong. If you think that these CEOs stay up nights worrying about gun control, you would be wrong. I think your point is a good point. Karl Rove and these folks have put together a very unholy alliance, and that alliance is led by the big money interests who, to a significant degree, play around with, if you like, a lot of other people and get them involved in politics. And in many instances, those folks, working-class people, lower-income people who get involved in Republican day-to-day politics, are working hard against their own best interests.
Brian in Raymond, New Hampshire, you're on the air with Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, I want to say Happy New Year, Senator-elect Sanders, and I wanted to point out, that rise right to your point, Bernie, a piece yesterday by Holly Sklar and CommonDreams.org, American Road Leads Off a Cliff. These corporations, they're cannibalizing our own people, our own citizenry, and among the largest 100 corporations in 2005, just 33 are U.S. companies, when in 2002, 38 were U.S. companies, 36 were European. Now 48 of the 100 largest companies are European, and the CEO worker pay gaps are much narrower at European companies
right.
than American companies. We need much stronger unions. Is that not right, Senator?
Well, got a long way to go to become a senator, but thanks for the thought. But the answer is you're absolutely right. Now, Holly Sklar, we just had her article, I think, up on our website just the other day. Holly is one of the few writers in this country who focuses on class issues and economic issues. And the point that you're making, Brian, is very true, and that is in many instances these large multinational corporations are selling out the American people. They're selling out their workers. And they are moving abroad, hiring people at desperately low wages, and are able to bring their products virtually tariff-free back into this country. And we've got to focus on that.
We just cannot allow the heads of these large corporations to go to war against the American middle class and to lower our standard of living.
Colleen in Gig Harbor, Washington, we have 1 minute left.
Hi. My question is about absentee balloting. We've been doing it here for several years, and I'm wondering, that leaves a paper trail. Why wouldn't it be good for the whole country to go that way?
Or you mean vote by mail, like we have in Oregon?
Uh-huh. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, I don't know about, I know that Oregon, for example, there are some states that have moved significantly in that direction. My own view is that in a democracy, we should make it as easy as we can for people to vote. We want the largest voter participation rate that we can have. Obviously, we have to have strong checks to make sure that fraud does not take place. Voter fraud is a very serious crime that should be punished. But we have got to reach out and figure out ways to get more people involved in the political process. And one of the concerns that I have right now is that the Republicans in states like Georgia and Ohio are moving in exactly the wrong direction and trying once again to make it hard for lower-income people and for minorities to participate in the political process.
Yeah, we're back to a poll tax in Georgia.
Exactly.
Now. It's amazing. Congressman Bernie Sanders, Bernie.org, his website, the only independent member of the House of Representatives running for the United States Senate as an independent. Be sure to check out Bernie.org. Bernie, thanks so much for being with us
today.
Good
to be with you, Tom. Happy New Year to everyone.
Thank you, and Happy New Year to you and yours. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, moving toward a bright and sparkling future by returning democracy to the United States of America. Yes, we can do it, my friends. If you and I get out there and get active, we can do it. 11 months to the next election. We'll be right back.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends, to the Real Free Speech Zone, the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 6 minutes past the hour. Last night, MTV ran a special, I guess it's called, an episode of their True Life series. And according to CNSNews.com, conservative website, a senior staff writer, Jeff Johnson, they portrayed gun owners as an unusual subculture, about half of whom are criminals. In fact, Jeff writes, while most gun owners are responsible, he's quoting from MTV. He says, while most gun owners are responsible, on average, every hour, somewhere between the ages of 15 and 28 is cut down by a bullet. The promotional statement continued, whether it's for protection, crime, or sports, guns are having a deep effect on the youth of our nation. Jeff Johnson with CNSNews.com. Jeff, is that not true?
Thanks for having me on the program, Tom.
Sure.
It depends on what you're looking at. One of the questions that I wanted to ask MTV was how they were defining cut down by a bullet. Were they including people whose lives were ended by a criminal use of a firearm? Were they including people who were injured or killed by the criminal use of a firearm? Or were they including accidents and legitimate self-defense shootings? So until I can talk to them, I can't answer that question for you.
I see. And suicides. I find it interesting that in the United States, in countries where you have largely in the United States, where we have ready access to firearms, the rate of suicide with firearms is much higher, and thus, in some cases, the suicide rate is higher than other countries.
Well,
in 2002, for example, you had 17,104 suicides in the United States committed using a firearm. That's 54%. A gun in a home is 11 times more likely to be used for a suicide than to injure or kill someone in self-defense.
What's the source of that statistic? Because I don't believe that's accurate.
The source of that particular statistic is the Journal of Trauma, 1998, Kellerman, and the title of the article in the Journal of Trauma is a peer-reviewed medical journal, Injuries and Deaths Due to Firearms in the Home.
Okay. I'm looking at handguns, homicides, and suicides, and this is United States Department of Justice, and it shows that while the rate of handgun ownership in the United States has steadily increased, the rates of both homicides and suicides have decreased.
Yeah, but that still doesn't, you know, contradict that if there is a gun in your home, it's 11 times more likely to be used in a suicide than in self-defense.
Well, radio's not a really good place to sit on the internet and do statistical research. I believe I could refute that if I had the time. But,
okay, well, here's a larger question.
Tom, I hope that we can discuss the MTV special in more detail, because that was one statistic out of the promotional blurb that was actually only cited once in the show, and there was a whole lot more information in the show. And as a matter of fact, I did a follow-up story. I don't know if you've had a chance to see it, but it's on the website today. And the one pro-gun group that had somebody stay up last night and watch the program that I talked to actually complimented MTV for their fairness in their treatment of the two legitimate gun owners in the program.
Okay. Great. And people can read your follow-up piece on CNSnews.com. And no, I haven't had an opportunity to see it. I apologize.
Okay. No, it's fine.
Question for you, Jeff. Speaking, first of all, as somebody who is a member of the NRA and who I enjoy shooting firearms as toys for boys, I got to say. You know, when I lived in Atlanta, there was a place down the road from us where I could go down and I could, rent an Uzi, you know, whatever I wanted, right, and do target practice. And I thought it was great fun. And in fact, a couple of my kids went down and you know, shot firearms. And maybe that's politically incorrect and people will take me to task for that, but that's what's so. And in that context, I was viewing it as that. Viva Rio, a group down in Brazil. Brazil is having a terrible problem right now with gun crimes and murders being done by guns. And Viva Rio has instituted a program where they're using supermodels in advertisements. At the same time that the government is doing a gun buyback program, they're using these supermodels in these advertising programs to suggest that men who are the most in love with guns are men who have the smallest penises. And this has resulted in over 400,000 people selling their guns back, you know, turning in their guns. It's working very successfully. Aren't we as a society really, haven't we kind of macho-ized guns to the point that there's a lot of insecure men out there who are using guns as their way of trying to feel like they're really a man?
Well, I don't know about that. I mean, I'm not a psychologist. I don't want to get accused of playing one on the radio. What I think there are a lot of people who have seen people around them, friends or coworkers or neighbors, become crime victims. They live in decent but not perfect neighborhoods, and they know that there is at least a fair risk that they might become a crime victim or a member of their family might become a crime victim. And if they have to face down, you know, for instance, someone with a knife or a firearm, or if they have to face down a small gang of thugs, they want to be able to have the most effective tool to defend themselves. And, you know, until we perfect the phaser from Star Trek, that's a firearm.
Well, back in 1988, the New England Journal of Medicine published a piece in which they looked at two cities that are side by side. I've been to both, spent a fair amount of time in both, Seattle, Washington, and Vancouver, British Columbia, over a six-year period from 1980 to 1986. These two cities had roughly identical rates of criminal activity and assault. In other words, the odds of walking down the streets in Seattle, the odds of walking down the streets in Vancouver, British Columbia, and being assaulted, being mugged, being stuck up, being robbed, were about the same. Having your house broke into, about the same. And yet, in Seattle, you had a 4.8-fold higher risk of being murdered with a handgun as opposed to in Vancouver. Why? Because the handguns were more readily available. Shouldn't we start wringing these things out of our general population and saying, you know, handguns are tools, are devices that really only have one purpose, and that's to kill people. If, you know, people want to use them for sport, let them go to a place like I did in Atlanta where you can practice, you can do target practice with them. But let's leave them in the hands of people like police, you know, who have a license to use them and know how to use them appropriately.
Well, I am a former police officer, and I can tell you that I know a lot of civilians who are much better trained with the handguns that they carry with a concealed carry permit than some of the police officers that I worked with, so I would definitely not advocate that as being the determining factor as to who can and cannot possess a handgun. What I would advocate is that we start very seriously considering long-term incarceration for people who use any firearm in the commission of a crime. I've talked about this on a number of radio programs around the country. I think the fact that your sentence is not significantly longer when you commit a violent crime using a firearm than it is when you commit a violent crime with your bare hands or any other weapon is part of the problem. You know, look at what we've done, the difference between reckless driving and drunk driving. We've determined that the penalty for drunk driving will be much more severe because you have impaired your ability to control that vehicle. I don't know, you know, who made the decision somewhere when the legislatures were writing the laws to say that, okay, if you drink and drive, it's much more serious than if you just drive recklessly. Why can't we look at violent crime and say, if you commit a violent crime, it's bad. If you commit a violent crime using a firearm, it's worse, and we're going to lock you up longer.
Well, a lot of states are doing that. We do that here in Oregon. But how do you, I mean, it seems to me like that's putting a Band-Aid on cancer. We've got a huge industry here. You know, and the NRA is its main spokesman, and let's be candid about this. The NRA is principally a lobbying organization for gun manufacturers.
Actually, the NRA is principally a lobbying organization for gun owners. The lobbying organization.
Well, they portray themselves that way. Again, I say this as an NRA member.
I'm sorry?
I say this as an NRA member. They portray themselves that way, but if you look at how they're spending their money, they're principally a lobbyist for the gun manufacturers, in my opinion. You've got a bunch of gun manufacturers out there, and you've got an entire industry, an entire entertainment industry, 60% of which, by the way, is owned by non-American corporations, who are glorifying gun violence in this country. I mean, isn't this a problem? Shouldn't we be addressing that issue at the same time that we make the use of guns, you know, crimes committed with guns more of a serious offense?
Well, I don't think that the success that we've seen in reducing, and I'll go back to this analogy because it's one I'm more familiar with, I don't think the success that we've seen in the reduction of drunk driving rates in this country should necessitate that we do away with cars. You know, somebody drives drunk, they've committed a crime, we punish them for committing the crime.
But we did do away with some of the promotion of alcohol.
Hang on a minute, Tom. You know, I've sat here, and you've got your statistics in a row, and you know what you want to say.
We got a minute left, Jeff. Go for it.
You know, why don't we hold people responsible for the choices that they make and punish them when they commit a crime? And I am equally willing to punish otherwise law-abiding gun owners who are irresponsible with their firearms. If you are the owner of a firearm and you are not storing that firearm safely and someone is injured as a result of your negligence, I think you should be punished for that, just like I think a criminal should be punished for the criminal misuse of a firearm.
Okay, well said. Jeff Johnson, he's a writer over at CNSnews.com. And you can check out his report over there, senior staff writer Jeff Johnson at CNSnews.com, about this program here on MTV. Jeff, thanks a lot for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Great talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We died in your hills and we died on your deserts. We died in your valleys, we died on your plains. We died in your trees and we died in your bushes. Both sides of the river, we've died just the same. Goodbye to my one, goodbye, Rosalita. Adios, mi amigos, Jesus y Maria.
And welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. I believe that's an old song from the Mexico-Texas Wars, whatever it was. Anyway, welcome back to our program. Deportee. Deportee. Okay. April 28th, 1996. A significant day. April 8th. By the way, welcome back to our program on the last Friday of the year 2005. And in a little bit, we may hear a few pithy comments from our commander-in-chief. But first, I just want to wrap this thing up with guns here. On April 28th, 1996, in Australia, there was a crazy guy, a disturbed man, let's say, went on a killing spree, killed 35 people, injured another 19. Just spraying out bullets. And this is referred to as the Port Arthur Massacre. And as a result of this, a year later, 1997, Australia had passed one of the most one of the strongest gun control laws among industrial states. And they also instituted a buyback program funded by the federal government, but states and the territories. And reimbursements were fairly generous. This program cost over $320 million Australian dollars. It'd be about $250 million U.S. dollars if my back-of-the-envelope arithmetic is right. And resulted in over 643,000 guns being turned back in. And this is the equivalent, by the way, considering the population of Australia, this would be the equivalent of 40 million guns in the United States being turned in. The result? In 1997, 21% of all homicides in Australia were committed with firearms. And in 2002, it was down to 16%, from 21 down to 2002. Australia saw a 44% decline in the use of firearms and armed robberies from 1993 to 2002. From 1997 to 2003, the proportion of robberies committed with a firearm dropped from 10 to 6%. Suicide rates using a firearm dropped almost in half, 48%, between 1991 and 2001. And firearm-related accidental injuries in Australia are also declining. So, the truth about what's going on in Australia, my take on this, it just seems to me that we have, I understand people having hunting rifles if they hunt. I mean, I don't. I'm a vegetarian. I mean, what am I going to, humans have historically hunted for food and for meat, and there are, places in this world where people do that actually for survival, and places in the United States where actually, hunting is actually, particularly in some of the poorer parts of this country, an important part of the diet. And, I understand that. I'm not being overtly critical of that. But a handgun is not designed to hunt with. A handgun is designed really for one thing, and that's to kill human beings. Now, it can also be used for sport, but if you're going to use something for sport, race cars are used for sport too, but we don't take them out on our public streets. And for that matter, baseballs are designed for sports, and you don't see people throwing baseballs up and down, Fifth Avenue. So, my take on this is that if we were to start an active campaign to wring some of the handguns out of our society, these millions and millions of firearms, we would see fewer suicides, we would see fewer homicides. This Vancouver study, this is a really significant study, and this is from the abstract of the study. And this, they looked at the Vancouver, British Columbia, and Seattle, Washington from 1980 to 1986. And the rate of assaults involving firearms was 7 times higher in Seattle than in Vancouver. Despite overall rates of criminal activity and assault, the relative risk of death from homicide adjusted for age and sex was significantly higher in Seattle than in Vancouver. Why? Because a gun is more deadly than a knife. Virtually all of this excess risk was explained by a 4.8-fold higher risk of being murdered with a handgun in Seattle as compared with Vancouver. And so, I think that it's time that we take a serious look at the work that James Brady is doing and others who are out there suggesting that we should have handgun control. At what level it should happen? I think certainly we already have some gun control at the federal level. You can't own a cannon. You can't own a Stinger missile. You can't, a shoulder fire. You can't own a bazooka. There's a whole lot of things that you can't own in that regard. But I also understand that New York City and Vermont should have really very different kinds of gun laws, frankly, because, in Vermont, a lot of people hunt, and in New York City, nobody hunts. So, it seems like it would be appropriate that as communities, they would take a different standard on this. George in Coos Bay, Oregon. Hey, George, what are your thoughts on this?
Yes, say a while ago, and the first line was, I have nothing against gun ownership, it's gun worship.
Yeah, George, let me ask you to hold on to that. I didn't realize we were just about to hit a break. I'm going to put you on hold here, and we'll pick up your question on the other side of this break. Tom Hartman radio program, 27 minutes past the hour, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy in the United States of America. Does that include the Second Amendment? We'll get into that. We'll be right back. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
It's jungle out there. Disorder and confusion everywhere. No one seems to care. Well, I do. Hey, who's in charge here?
Hey, welcome back. Amazing. Our bumper music is the theme song to my favorite TV program, Monk. Welcome back, my friends. Yes, the year in review.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top. That encourages entrepreneurship. What we Republicans should stand for is growth in the economy. We ought to make the pie higher.
Yeah, we ought to make the pie higher. And, yeah, you cut taxes for Bill Gates, and that is going to make it easier for entrepreneurs to start businesses to compete with Bill Gates. Somehow I don't get it. It doesn't make sense. Anyhow, we were talking about gun control. George and Coos Bay. George, you were making a point.
Oh, hello, Tom. Yeah, when George starts talking about making the pie higher, I think of cow pie.
Yeah.
My point is that I think the Democrats should have a motto as far as the Second Amendment, and that is gun ownership, not gun worship, because it really is like a religion with the NRA people.
Yeah.
You know, there's only about 4 million members of the NRA, and there's like 80 or 100 million gun owners. So, why don't 80 million gun owners join the NRA?
Well, the NRA is out there. I mean, you know, they have actually good education programs, and they have some good programs for hunters and things like that. And,
I agree.
And, you know,
I took those education programs when I was 12, but, you know, some of us grew up. And
there you go. And
Michael Moore is a lifetime NRA member.
Yeah. Oh, I didn't know that. That's interesting.
He did well. And if you saw Bowling for Columbine.
Yeah,
I did.
That
just requires viewing for anybody that owns a gun, I'd say.
Yeah.
And it shows the religious aspect of it.
Yeah.
They even have a Bible, you know, the American Rifleman, and they have as much influence in the White House as Jerry Falwell and Pat the Assassin Robertson.
Well, LaPierre, the president of the NRA, had said, you know, if George Bush gets this is in 2000, if George Bush gets elected, we'll be able to set up an office in the White House.
Yeah.
And
right, the Oval Office.
Yeah, yeah. And
well,
and
I thank you very much, and I just think that the Democrats need to they need to neutralize this argument that if we have Democrats in office, that Hillary and Teddy are going to kick down your door with an army of stormtroopers and take away your, you know, 30-30 hunting rifle.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Well said, George. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, and Happy New Year to you, by the way. I don't think that any reasonable politicians out there are saying that we should be an absolutely gun-free nation. Canada, actually, as Michael Moore pointed out in Bowling for Columbine, Canada actually has more guns per capita than the United States does, but they're hunting rifles. And they have much less gun violence. And now we have, you know, the mayor of Toronto out here just absolutely flipped out and, you know, going on, you know, very concerned about this. He's saying that police statistics show that about half the guys, they're seeing an increase in gun violence in Toronto. And he said, we need to advocate in the United States for them to have stronger gun control laws. Police statistics show that about half the guns that they are able to determine the origin of are from the United States. In other words, our weapons are being smuggled into their country. And my point for our last guest was that we are, you know, we have an industry that is aggressively promoting the use of these devices, these things that are really only made for one purpose. There's basically kind of two products out there in our society that, when used as directed, cause death: tobacco and handguns. I mean, you know, handguns are there to shoot people. And tobacco, you know, nobody realized, I think, you know, when Sir Walter Raleigh first went back to Europe and said, hey, you got to try out this herb I got in North America, nobody realized it killed people, but sure enough, it does. So anyhow, we've got that topic, and we'll be sharing more Bushisms with you. It's the end of the year. Some of the more outrageous things of the year. What's going on? We have a Berlusconi alert right now. Will in Brea, California. Hey, Will, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up, Will?
Way cool. Well, real quick, I just had a question. Isn't there the fact that we've been attacked again since 9/11 with the Ricin incident, where the Democrats and unfriendly newspapers to the administration were attacked, and they're like terrorism behind that?
Are you talking about anthrax?
Yeah, well, it was an anthrax. I thought it was Ricin or something that the couple of different Democratic officials got in the mail, and then newspaper people or TV people.
I I'd have to go back and look at that, Will. I recall that there was concern about that, and I don't remember if that turned out to be a hoax or not. I
understand that they've played it off that it is a hoax. They went after the wrong guy like usual, and turned out they were wrong, and now nothing exists. It never happened.
Yeah. The larger concern for me, whether or not there was a Ricin attack, is why are we not even discussing, much less still looking for, the anthrax killer? I mean, this is what led to the passage of the Patriot Act.
Exactly. Well, I guess it was the anthrax I was referring to.
Anthrax. There were two guys in the United States Senate. When Jim Jeffords in 2001 said enough already, when the Bush administration was trying to destroy education in the United States, and that was Jeffords' pet issue and has been for all the 50 some odd years he's been a Republican. Jeffords is probably pushing 70 now. When the Bushies went over the top, he said, that's it, a lifelong Republican, member of the United States Senate from Vermont, and he said, that's it, I'm out of here, and he became an independent. And when that happened, control of the Senate went to the Democrats. And when control of the Senate went to the Democrats, then the Patriot Act came forward right after 9/11, and there were two men who stood in the way of the Patriot Act. And that was Pat Leahy, who was the Democratic senator from Vermont, Jim Jeffords' colleague, actually, who was the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, and Tom Daschle, who was the head of the Senate, period. I mean, you know, he was the president of the Senate is the vice president. I'm forgetting
one
the
of
time.
Them.
Yeah, there you go. And these two guys are the only two guys who happen to get anthrax. And I just find that very strange. I don't have any particular conspiracy theory to account for it. I just find it very strange. So,
didn't the Germans have something called the Patriot Act?
Yeah, it was actually called the Act for the Protection of Patriotic Germans, and we refer to them as the Enabling Acts. You can read about it in William Scherer's book, The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich. And Hitler got these passed about 3 months after the burning of the Reichstag, or excuse me, about 3 weeks after the burning of the Reichstag, the parliament building in Germany, right after he was appointed chancellor. And they had a 4-year sunset provision on them, by the way. That was the only way he could get them through parliament. So, yeah, surprise, surprise. Will, thanks a lot.
Keep going, Kurt Teller, later.
Oh, yeah. Good hearing from you, and Happy New Year. Ken in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Ken, welcome to the program.
Yeah, thanks, Tom. It's a great show. Hey, look, I'm for carrying handguns, and the reason I'm for it is if I go walking in the woods, I hate to carry a hunting rifle, but if you come upon something like a bear, you're not going to be able to throw a rock at it. I mean, you got to...
Well, this is Ken.
That it's absolute death coming out of the end of that. Yeah. I'm a vet. I know what comes out of the end. But I'll tell you what, you can't say, wait a minute, while I go back and get whatever I need to take care of this current situation. When you go out there, you got to go out there prepared at the best you can be for whatever you're going to come up against.
But, Ken, isn't there a point where we do a risk-benefit analysis where we say, okay, we've got thousands of children in the United States who have died as a result of accidental death from handguns being in houses. We have thousands a year of people, over 10,000 people a year, who commit suicide with handguns, who in countries where handguns are not readily available don't. And we have, you know, crime going nuts with handguns. And how many people die because of bears in the United States every year?
Well,
I don't
have a problem with that. I don't have any kids in my house. And if I want to go out there, when I go out there, I want to go out to protect it. If I don't go out to protect it, I may not come back at all.
Yeah, what's wrong with carrying mace or a stun gun? I mean, those will both stop
a bear. You try a stun gun on something that really can take you out?
I don't know. Frankly, I don't know if a stun gun would be appropriate for a bear, but I do know, I have seen in wilderness magazines that you should carry mace, that you can stop a bear with it.
Oh, boy. Yeah.
You don't think so?
Well, yeah. Well, I'll tell you what. When I go out there, I carry what I think I'm going to need.
Yeah.
And I don't always need a hunting rifle. That's a lot to carry.
Yeah.
And I hope I never have to draw the weapon.
Yeah. Know? Well, I hope you never have to do to either, Ken. And that's you know, I guess we'll just have to agree to disagree. I just think that the cost to society for any of us to be able to walk around with a gun in the event that a bear is going to show up is just too high.
You have to take responsibility for whenever you use it. There are plenty of laws in place that say if you're not 21 years old, you can't have a handgun at all.
Yeah.
You know?
No, I understand. I understand all that.
The laws are in place.
But still, and you can make the argument, okay, you know, we license people who drive cars. Why don't we license people who have handguns and all that? And a lot of states do, of course. But still, I think, you know, just looking at the cost to society, I have a problem with it. I you look at societies like Australia and Canada and the United Kingdom and France and Germany where handguns are very, very hard to come by. And you really have to demonstrate that you have a need to have one, and you have to demonstrate that you're competent in order to be able to carry one. And
well,
you don't have these high suicide rates, and you don't have these high rates of childhood death. You don't have people breaking into people's houses and stealing guns. I mean, I just have a concern with that, Ken.
Well, the armed.
Yep, I'm sorry. I just dropped you. I thought I was clicking a different button. But anyhow, we're just going to have to agree to disagree on this one. I mean, I don't know where we can go beyond that. The classic. This is, you know, what you're suggesting is that the fear. In fact, Alex just makes this point greatly. Alex Goldmark, he says the classic Republican mentality: fear of the unlikely, the infinitely unlikely harm to me justifies terrible costs to others. And, you know, well said, Alex. Thank you. And yeah, that's the point I'm trying to make. So we'll continue the conversation, and we'll be taking your calls. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-8466, right after this. It's 45 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman Radio Program. The real free speech zone. No barbed wire, no RNC pass required. You won't be dragged off if you've got a No Blood for Oil bumper sticker on your car. Welcome to the program. We'll be right back.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
We'll talk a cop for kindness yet for days of sun.
And have a safe and peaceful and wonderful new year. Welcome back, my friends. It is 9 minutes before the hour of the Tom Hartman radio program. In our chat room, you can get to by going to tomhartman.com, clicking live chat. Imbalio says, wait a minute, how am I going to stop, I'm paraphrasing here, how are we going to stop a renegade government if we, you know, if we don't have guns? Well, first of all, I'm not saying we should not have any guns at all. But secondly, think for a minute. How much good did all those guns, even the high-powered ones that David Koresh had, do, you know, what good did that do him? My recollection is, you know, virtually none, no good at all. And you know, that is the problem, a very real and significant problem, and that is that you can't, you know, the Second Amendment is not there so that we can take out the government if they get out of control. A lot of people try to pitch that, and that's not why it's there. The Second Amendment is there as a result of a compromise between two factions among the framers, one led by Jefferson, who didn't want there to be a standing army during time of peace, and the other led by Hamilton, who thought that we should have a standing army at all times. And Jefferson wanted us to have a Swiss-style army where everybody has a gun in their closet, a rifle in their closet, and when the church bells ring a certain, but no army. And when the church bells ring a certain way, then every able-bodied man between the ages of 17 and 47 grabs his rifle, steps out into the street, and boom, the entire populace is mobilized. And many folks suggest that that's why Hitler would never invaded Switzerland. It was because, you know, every man in Switzerland is a member of the army. So that's why we have the Second Amendment, is because of the result of that compromise. But that gets lost on people. Dave in St. Paul. St. Paul, is that Nebraska?
Yes, it is.
Hey, Dave, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom. I enjoy your show.
Thank you.
I just had to answer the fellow that was concerned for his safety on bears. The rangers that deal with bears specifically and go out and manage them
carry
park rangers. You're talking federal employees.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, they carry it at kind of a high-grade pepper spray.
Yeah, see, this is the thing. I have read in sports magazines that you should carry these, that there is pepper spray that will stop a bear. It'll blind it and make it run away.
Yes, I carry it myself. We have a cougar problem around here. They're kind of moving in. And particularly during primitive weapons and bow season, you know, you're not allowed to carry firearms. And we've had some cats creep up on people.
Yeah, yeah.
And, well, Dave, besides that, how many rounds it would take to kill a bear?
Yeah, and they would have to be very accurately fired.
Yes, it'd have to be a headshot at close range at very high caliber, and I think you'd be a little bit rattled if they're coming down on you.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Dave, thanks a lot for the call.
No
appreciate
problem.
It. And beyond that, even if the gun was the only way to kill the bear, I think we have to get back to the question of, are, you know, tens of thousands of human deaths every year worth, you know, balance that against saving two or three people who want to go out in the woods and get eaten by bears every year, or whatever the number is. It's got to be fairly small. Hank in Durham, Michigan. Hey, Hank, welcome to the program.
Hi. I'd like to back up just a little bit. I missed the segment with Bernie there.
Mm-hmm.
I've been going through his website yesterday a little bit, and it seems to me that there is a concerted effort over there in that part of the country to amass millions of dollars to keep Bernie from winning when he's running for the Senate.
You're right. It's already underway. The conservative alerts have been trotting these things out about him, and he's running against the richest guy in the state of Vermont, who has already pledged $5 million of his own money for the campaign.
Okay. I'm just trying to get your take on that. It's like,
yeah.
I couldn't believe it.
Now, Bernie is up against it like very few senators are up, or candidates for the United States Senate are up against it this year, and it's going to be a real challenge for him, and that's why I encourage people to check out Bernie.org, his website, and help him out if you can.
Exactly. Okay, well, thanks for your time, Tom.
Thank you, Dora. Good to hear from you. Mark in Suffington, Connecticut. Hey, Mark.
Hey, how you doing?
Great. What's up?
Hey, I have just a couple questions for you. I am a registered independent, and I wanted to get your feel on a couple things. I am anti-gun. I am for national health care. I don't support abortion. I do think it should be legal. But the one thing that does concern me that the Democrats, I feel, are lacking in is national security. And that is
give me an example of that.
I think Bush made the right decision to go into Iraq. I think he is acting in what he deems the best for the American people.
Yeah, I just have to disagree with you, Mark. I think that by going into Iraq, Bush not only harmed this nation, he harmed our military. He has led to the death of thousands of our soldiers, the dismemberment of tens of thousands of our soldiers, and all, you know, unnecessarily.
Now, let me ask you.
Tell me, what is the national security interest that was served by inflaming the Middle East and attacking Iraq like
that? Well, this is what I think, okay? I thought that after September 11th, something needed to be done because when you go back, even Clinton was criticized for not really addressing the terrorist situation. And
no, Clinton was aggressively addressing the terrorist situation,
well,
and every time
he
tried to... Every time he tried to attack the terrorists, he got attacked by the Republicans for trying to distract people from Monica.
Okay, I'm just trying to make a point, because Bush also was criticized after it happened. So I think that Bush was acting on the fact that he can't be criticized anymore for just sitting back and doing nothing.
No, I don't think for a minute that Bush invaded Iraq because he was afraid of being criticized for doing nothing. Bush in 1999 said that his father had a lot of political capital when he invaded Iraq, and he wasted it because the war didn't last long enough.
Right.
If he became president and he had an opportunity to invade Iraq, this is what he told his biographer in 1999, family friend. He says,
yep.
If I have a chance to invade Iraq, I'm not going to waste that political capital. The invasion of Iraq, Mark, very simply, was for the purpose of getting the Republicans elected in 2002 and for Bush to get himself reelected in 2004. In my opinion, he did it for purely political purposes. He may have done it for oil. I think that was a side benefit. This is not a war that we're involved in. This is the crime of the century, what Bush did, driving our troops, destroying our army and our National Guard and ripping our nation apart. And inflaming the Middle East and taking a billion Muslims who were actually on our side after 9/11, hating Osama bin Laden, and putting them against us. That's wrong. We are not safer because of that.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
Are you...
calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded? Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. TomHartman.com, if you want to drop into our live chat room, 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number, toll-free nationwide, 1-866-440-8466. And it just gets stranger and stranger, you know? Yeah, here we go. It is, you'll recall, Mr. Silvio Berlusconi. This is our official Berlusconi alert music, of course. So time for a Berlusconi alert. There you go, yeah. See, Berlusconi, small-time crook, entrepreneur. You know, not one of those guys who was piling the pie higher, really. It's a small-time entrepreneur. He buys a radio station, and he buys a TV station. And then he buys a newspaper, and then he buys another radio station, and then he buys another TV station. And then he buys another radio station. Then he buys a radio network. And then he buys a TV network. And then he buys another radio network. And then he buys another TV network. And then he buys another newspaper. And then pretty soon, he controls 95% of the media, the ability to reach 95% of all the people in the country of Italy. And then, Silvio Berlusconi decides to run for prime minister. What a surprise! He wins! His party wins! Well, it turns out that he was able to acquire all those radio and TV stations and newspapers and everything else with a little help from his friends. And some of his friends are now going to prison for it. So this from the Associated Press, Dateline Rome. Milan prosecutors have placed Italy's premier under investigation for allegedly bribing a lawyer to give false testimony in court cases against the leader, lawyers for both men said on Thursday. Prosecutors have accused Mr. Berlusconi of ordering the payment of at least $600,000 to British lawyer David Mills in 1997 to convince him to give false testimony in two of Mr. Berlusconi's trials on bribery, false bookkeeping, and other charges. There you go. Indeed. Our Berlusconi alert for the day. And a cautionary tale, I would say, to everybody in the United States about what happens when one guy ends up owning, or one party ends up owning, or one bunch ends up owning most of your media. Our Berlusconi alert for the day. Indeed. And thanks to, we've been doing these for so many years, for a couple of years now. Thanks to the many folks who forwarded it to us, by the way. It's amazing. It's getting to the point where with Berlusconi alerts, I'm not usually the first one to catch them. It's my listeners. I love it. We've got the smartest listeners on the planet. Speaking of which, 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number, Roger in Townwater, Washington, on the line. Hey, Roger, welcome to the program.
Happy New Year's, Tom.
Well, thank you. Happy New Year's to you, Roger.
I'm kind of in a quandary. My congressman is Brian Beard,
mm-hmm.
3rd Congressional District.
I know Brian.
But come November, I'm planning not to vote for him.
Because?
As much as I dislike Republicans, both parties serve the same master, and that is the corporate interest.
Well, as parties, you know, I'm not going to argue with that as parties. I would say that as Democrats go, Brian Baird has made some votes with which I disagree.
I do, as you know,
I do a local program on KPOJ, AM 620 in Portland every morning. and before I do this program, and which covers Vancouver, Washington, which is Brian Baird's district. And once a week, I have Brian Baird on the program, along with Peter DeFazio and Earl Blumenauer and other, you know, several. We try to get as many of the congressional delegation on as we can. Gordon Smith won't come on. Occasionally, Maria Cantwell comes on. We have Ron Wyden on from time to time. But Brian's on pretty much every week. And I got to tell you, I think that he's more with us than against us, and particularly when it comes to corporate, not just corporate, but particularly when it comes to corruption. And frankly, I think that Brian is a great example of what happens, what can happen when a Democrat who perhaps has been kind of, you know, going, blowing with the wind to some extent with regard to corporations pushing in one direction or the other, starts being held up to public scrutiny and starts being getting pressure from progressives, and he starts becoming more progressive. Because my sense, since we've been featuring Brian on the program and talking about progressive issues with him, that he's been becoming far more progressive.
Well, that's hopeful. But I haven't seen him do anything as far as the Patriot Act and some of the other atrocities that have taken place in recent years.
Well, I'd have to go through his voting list. I don't have it right in front of me, but I specifically I don't recall. I know, you know, I don't even want to, because I'm trying to keep track of, you know, seven different members of Congress from that are in that radio station area, and I can't keep them all in my head at once. But the bottom line is that the first vote that a member of Congress makes is their most important vote, and that's to vote for their leadership. And because that defines everything. The leadership then defines the agenda. They decide what bills come to the floor. They decide what's going to get voted on, what's going to get discussed, everything. They decide everything. And so in that regard, even a weak Democrat is better than even a liberal, even a more liberal Republican right now, because the Republican Party is so badly corrupted. The Democratic Party is only half corrupted, in my opinion.
And that's exactly why I'm in a quandary.
Well, see, the solution to this, Roger, is for folks like you and me to get inside the Democratic Party and start changing it.
I've tried. I've actually ran for political office, and the Democratic Party did everything in their power to make sure that I wasn't elected.
Well, have you joined the Democratic Party? This is the thing. I mean,
that was 20 years ago.
Yeah. Well, see, we have, for example, I'll just give you an example. I don't know if he's listening today. A fellow by the name of Jeff in Denver, who's a regular listener to this program, and about a year and a half, 2 years ago, Jeff would call up and fairly regularly call up and say, you know, I don't know. Yeah, I'm going with the Greens. You know, I just, you know, the Democrats, they're corporate sellouts and all that. And I said, you know, I think the Greens on the local level are doing marvelous work, and I encourage people to participate with the Green Party. However, at the national level, we really do have a two-party system here, and we need to be taking back the Democratic Party. And Jeff went to a local Democratic Party meeting and discovered that there weren't that many folks there, and most of them were, you know, shall we say, over the hill. And I say that respectfully as a fellow in my 50s himself. And they weren't, you know, it had become an old boy network. And so he got a bunch of friends together, and they showed up at one of the next meetings, and they, you know, they started running. And he ended up being elected one of the guys who actually went to the Democratic Party. He put together a proposal that actually got on the state ballot in Colorado. I mean, he's actually changed the politics of his entire state because he showed up for that meeting. And he got some friends of his to come along, enough friends, enough progressives to come along that they were able to take control of a county Democratic Party group. And so that's why I say, Roger, we've got to, this is, you know, democracyforamerica.com, you know, it's a great place to start. Howard Dean's brother is running that thing, Jim Dean. And I think that, you know, we really need to get involved in this. So, Roger, that's my suggestion for what it's worth.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate it, and I wanted to express my concern.
Yeah. Well, and I appreciate that, and I thank you for calling with that. Rebecca in Linwood, Washington. Hey, Rebecca, welcome to the program.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
Tom, can you hear me?
I can.
Okay, good. I'm on a cell phone. Have you heard about the airline protection program that Raytheon, BAE, and Northrop Grumman are proposing that would cost taxpayers $11 billion the first year and $2 billion annually for maintenance after that? And it's to put weapons on airplanes at the cost of $1 million each, or to surround airports, the major airports, with little towers and defensive machines or weapons. And it's a huge plum for the defense industry, and I wonder if you've heard about this.
You know, I've heard a reference to it. I have not seen any detailed specifics of it.
You can go, I think you can watch the hearing or the presentations by these three companies about their different plans.
Yeah, they're pitching it to Congress right now, you mean?
It's just, to me, you were talking about weapons earlier,
mm-hmm.
or you were talking about handguns, but I think I've heard recently that it is now legal to own what they call the Barrett 50 caliber light.
Oh, yeah, has been for a long time.
Pardon?
The 50 caliber guns have been legal for a long, long time, and you can shoot down an airliner with one.
Yeah, and they can reach over 2,000 yards.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I'm thinking, okay, so we're going to put $1 million on an airplane to protect them against something that we allow?
Right, that we really shouldn't allow, because a 50 caliber gun is really useful for taking out a tank, but, you know, it's really not a lot useful for hunting. If you shot a deer with it, you wouldn't have a deer left. In fact, it would take out the tree behind the deer. Rebecca, thanks for the call. I'll look into the details of this a little more thoroughly and report back with you on it. And we want to get into our Bushisms of the day. Some of our 2005, the year in review, and the news of the day. Right after this, 16 minutes past the hour, I'm Tom Hartman.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Welcome back, my friends. Yeah, we're still talking about guns over in the chat room. Sue says she's competed in military competitions with machine guns. Whoa! Sue over in Milton Keynes, UK, in England, running our chat room for us. You can get to it by going to tomhartman.com. And she sent us a beautiful calendar this year. Thank you, Sue. That was very sweet of you. And Groucho, yes, too many high-end weapons available in the streets, and Imbalio and I are having this discussion. He says, you know, how are we going to stop the government if it gets out of control, and you know, if we don't have enough guns? And I'm saying, you know, having a lot of guns did not help David Koresh. When George Herbert Walker Bush decided to take on David Koresh, and then Bill Clinton came into office and inherited this, you know, ongoing program against these guys. And I'm not saying this in support of Koresh at all, but just, you know, value neutral around that. That's a whole other discussion. But, you know, having all the guns in the world, or practically, didn't help those guys at all. I mean, you know, they brought in tanks, flamethrowers, that is not the way you defend yourself. And so he says, well, what do you do? And I said, well, I think Gandhi had some pretty good ideas. And he says, well, I prefer Malcolm X. And, you know, and my response would be, look what happened to Malcolm X. In fact, it's interesting. Just on this last weekend, I was listening to one of Malcolm X's last speeches. In fact, I was thinking about cutting it up and playing parts of it on the air, because it was really a brilliant, brilliant speech. But anyhow, the events got away from me. It has been a very, very strange year. And I think that it might be a good time for us to consider some of the things that, you know, George W. Bush has shared with us. Lighten the day here for us.
A lot of fine print in your plan, Mr. Vice President, in all due respect. It is, I'm not so sure 80% of the people get the death tax. I know this, 100% will get it if I'm the president at this.
Yeah, okay. That from the debate. Of course, one of his more famous sayings.
If this were a dictatorship, it'd be a heck of a lot easier. Just so long as I'm the dictator.
Yeah, and thus that famous, and George W. Bush's famous inability to say, I'm wrong, or shame on me. The words can't even come out of his mouth.
For the last 5 years.
Whoa, how do we get Bernie Sanders in there? I don't know. That's anyhow. Here's all, Bush, the haves and the have more.
This is an impressive crowd, the haves and the have mores. Some people call you the elite. I call you my base.
Yeah, chuckle, chuckle, tee hee, roar, roar. And so, of course, Bush always keeping an eye out on ways to keep us safe, right?
Our enemies are innovative and resourceful. And so are we.
They never stop thinking about new ways to harm our country and our people, and neither do we.
And you know, these are just, you know, malaprops. He's just, you know, just not saying what he means, but still sometimes I think there's an unconscious slip here. Mark Crispin Miller wrote an entire book about this called The Bush Dyslexicon, saying that George Bush is very, very articulate when he's talking about punishing, but he's very inarticulate when he's talking about poverty or helping people.
First, let me make it very clear, poor people aren't necessarily killers. Just because you happen to be not rich doesn't mean you're willing to kill.
Yeah, see, we have to explain these things at length, of course. And you know, being a doctor, for example.
We got an issue in America. Too many good docs are getting out of business. Too many OBGYNs aren't able to practice their love with women all across this country.
Yeah, the reason why is because there's a law against it. But anyhow, one of the most tragic of the Bushisms was when Bush was at one of his campaign speeches. And he got this woman up on stage, presumably a Republican, a good Republican, who knows. And it turned out that this woman, as a result of his marvelous economy, was working three jobs. And George just thought that was the most marvelous thing.
There's a certain comfort to know that the promises made will be kept by the government. You don't have to worry.
That's good, because I work three jobs and I feel like I contribute.
You work three jobs?
Three jobs, yes.
Uniquely American, isn't it? I mean, that is fantastic that you're doing that. You get any sleep?
Yeah, and then he makes a joke to her about it. You get any sleep? You wonder about, you know, his ability to empathize with these things, you know, with these, well, just, you know.
You're working hard to put food on your family.
Yeah, you're working hard to put food on your family. Mm-hmm, yeah. And, of course, his famous...
There are some who feel like that, you know, the conditions are such that they can attack us there. My answer is bring them on.
Yeah, and they did. They did. And that was one of the big tragedies of the Bush presidency, and certainly an ongoing tragedy of 2005. Here's another one.
Brownie, you're doing a heck of a job.
Yeah. Brownie, you're just doing one heck of a job. So, looking back at 2005, and that's enough of that. I want to talk to you after the break about some of the economic indicators for this coming year and some of the concerns that we have about them and, you know, what it may mean to the United States to have George W. Bush as president and Republicans in control of Congress. 27 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman radio program, where being progressive never felt so good.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman program.
Makes a move of which we don't approve. Who is it that always intervenes? UN and OAS, they have their place, I guess. But first, send the Marines.
There you go.
Well, send them all we've got. John Wayne and Randolph Scott. Remember those exciting fighting scenes. To the shores of Tripoli, but not to Mississippi. What do? We send the Marines.
And welcome back to our program, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour. Coming up on 25 before. 46 Guantanamo detainees joined the hunger strike this on Christmas Day. Where is the coverage of this? Here we've got, we have 84 people now in Guantanamo Bay who are refusing to eat. 32 of them have been hospitalized and are being force-fed through nasal tubes. The rest under close medical observation. The attorneys for some of these people say that they're starting to look like people who stepped out of Dachau at the liberation. Attorneys for reporters for the prisoners reported over the summer that between 100 and 200 detainees had launched a hunger strike in July. It's ongoing. It resumed on August 8th amid new tensions over rumors that a guard had manhandled a prison. The number of detainees refusing meals has fluctuated from as few as two dozen to as many as 131. I mean, this is Joshua Congelo Bryan, a volunteer attorney who represents several Bahraini detainees who were arrested in Pakistan. He says in general, the detainees use the tactic out of desperation. He says, at this point, none of this surprises me, considering the conditions that our people are held under and the indefinite nature of their detention. If, at a particular time, more detainees chose to protest in what they see as the only effective manner, that seems consistent with a general sense of despair, frustration, and hopelessness. I mean, imagine if you were, I can't say arrested, if you were seized and thrown into a prison and told, you may never get out of here. In fact, in all probability, you'll never get out of here. We just gave you a death sentence. You say, wait a minute, I would like to speak to a judge. No, sorry, we just gave you a death sentence. Well, how about a jury? No, sorry, a life sentence. You're here forever. You may get a death sentence. We started this, another one of the more infamous things of 2005. This was, the BBC reported this. I remember back during the summer, June or July, as I recall, that we started building Camp 6 in Guantanamo, a death chamber. We are building, if you read the news, you know this, we are building a death chamber in Guantanamo to put to death those detainees that we decide have committed crimes worthy of the death penalty. And when that story got out, that the Americans, that we already have 5 concentration camps in Guantanamo Bay, and that we're building a 6th, and it will be a death camp, you know, specifically to kill people, didn't go well, didn't go over well in Europe at all. And now we've got 46 more detainees who just joined this thing over the Christmas holiday. Well, actually, on Christmas Day. There are credible allegations, this from the BBC, credible allegations that Guantanamo hunger strikers are being force-fed in a cruel manner, a UN source reporter on torture has said. This is, we actually had one of the lawyers for one of the detainees on this program some time back. He's saying essentially the same thing. He told the BBC that he had received reports that some hunger strikers had had thick pipes inserted through their nose and forced down into the stomach. This was allegedly done roughly, sometimes by prison guards rather than doctors. As a result, prisoners reported bleeding and vomiting to pump food into them. The military does this if they miss more than 9 consecutive meals. Apparently, that would be punishment beyond that. These people have been held nearly 4 years without any charges at all. The BBC notes human rights campaigners expressing growing concern about the treatment of inmates at Guantanamo. Bush administration denying allegations of abuse, insisting it does not torture prisoners, but will not let anyone inspect it. I seem to recall hearing similar stories some 5 decades ago. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Jeff in Dallas, Texas. Hey, Jeff, welcome to the program.
I wanted to talk about, first of all, I'm concerned about extrajudicial executions here in the United States at some point, if they bring that here. But my point was, I wanted to bring up the 50 caliber rifle issue.
Right.
I think it's kind of a disingenuous argument to even imply that they might be for deer hunting. That's not the point. I think the real issue that we should be concentrating on is, I cringe at the day that we should ever have to water the Tree of Liberty here in the United States. But, that's something that we need to be aware of. And I think that's the real issue that we should be concerned about. As long as the government has tanks, and, I have no problem with, I personally don't have a 50 caliber rifle, but if sane people on the right and hopefully on the left as well have them, I think that's the argument right there, not whether or not they can be used.
That's the argument for what?
For owning them, for citizens owning them. Maybe a well-regulated militia, but it needs to be something out of the reach of...
But the point of the well-regulated militia in the Second Amendment was to defend the United States, not to take on the government of the United States. Jeff, have you ever been close to any of the United States military? I mean, you're talking about a force that is absolutely overwhelming.
Of course.
There is no way, even if every single person in the United States even had a 50 caliber gun, that they could take down the U.S.
Right
Army.
Now, that force is in Iraq right now, and the local insurgents are keeping them at bay, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, what I'm saying is if the people of the United States get into a situation similar to that, I'm not talking about some David Koresh thing. I'm talking about a full-scale takeover of this country. And,
but see, here's the distinction. The people of Iraq, this is why I don't think, first of all, number one, I don't think that that's practical or even possible because the people of this country, the people of Iraq are fighting against an occupation, what they perceive to be an external army that has come in and is occupying their country.
Uh-huh.
And therefore, they will fight to the death for that, as we did against Great Britain.
And that argument couldn't be made that could happen in this country?
No, I don't think Canada or Mexico are going to invade us.
No,
if they did,
no,
I would take up arms against them.
Not Canada or Mexico, the United States.
Right, and that's why this is why I don't think that'll happen, Jeff, is because if you look at history, when you see revolutions from within countries, when the Nazis took over Germany, for example, when Mussolini took over Italy, when Franco took over Spain, when Pinochet, I mean, on and on it goes, when essentially dictators take over countries, you don't have popular uprisings. They get put down very quickly because and in the name of patriotism.
Okay.
And that's why I just don't, you know, I read the Turner Diaries back when what's his name, Tim McVeigh brought down the federal building in Oklahoma City.
And that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about concerned citizens who are sane, okay?
But see, that's what that book... Are you familiar with the book, and are you familiar with Tim McVeigh's thinking on this?
Yeah,
Read Gore Vidal's, you know, book about him?
Actually, I read parts of it, yes.
It's really fascinating. I think probably for the benefit of our listeners, we should just, you know, lay this out. Tim McVeigh had read this book called The Turner Diaries, which is a frankly badly written novel by a guy who's, as I recall, his pen name was McDonald. His I don't remember his real name now. He's a physicist, actually, not a writer. And in this book, you get this repressive government that starts illegally wiretapping and breaking into people's homes and having people disappear, and the president says he doesn't need court orders to do things, and it becomes so oppressive that, yeah, sort of. And it becomes, well, see, McVeigh thought that it had happened,
right,
you know, with Waco, that was the beginning of it, that Clinton had become the, you know, the anti-American or the anti-Christ or anti-president or whatever. And in that book, there's a guy blows up a federal building in the United States, a federal building in Oklahoma City, and the government response to that is so brutal and repressive. In other words, basically, the president declares war on the terrorists inside the United States. The response is so repressive that all the good white Christians with guns rise up.
I want it to be made clear that I'm not advocating that.
Okay? No, I understand.
I
understand
that. What I want to know is I want it to be known that if tanks roll down the streets, and I don't think that that's possible that could happen soon, and I just want to make sure that that's the focus of the argument, not whether or not you can use a 50 caliber rifle to hunt deer. Do you understand what I'm saying?
I do, and
that's the argument we should be having.
But I don't think you're getting my point, Jeff, which is that fantasy that Tim McVeigh had. I mean, when Tim McVeigh blew up the federal building, it did not cause an American revolution like he thought it would. Instead, it caused a lot of people to be horrified. Just like when bin Laden hit us on 9/11, it did not cause the Islamic world to say, oh, let's get America, isn't that wonderful? There was a candlelight vigil in Tehran, Iran.
Mm-hmm.
And if Bush's response to bin Laden was the response that in the Turner Diaries, you know, that Tim McVeigh thought was going to be directed against, you know, the militia movement in the United States. And it wasn't. Bill Clinton did the right thing. He said, this guy is a criminal. He's a psychopath. He's a criminal. We're going to track him down using police powers. We're going to put him in prison. We're going to prosecute him. And ultimately, they put him to death.
Okay,
that, you know,
I just wanted to straightened out the argument there that that's what it's about. I'm not advocating that we should uprise against the government. I'm saying that's the argument we should be having. That's
no, I understand that. And I understand that there's a lot of people out there who think that the whole point of and I appreciate the call, Jeff, and you're making your point. And there's a lot of people out there who think that the whole point of the Second Amendment is that we should have guns to be able to fight back the government. And I'm saying, A, that's not why the Second Amendment was put in there. It was put in there because Jefferson and others thought that we should not have a standing army during times of peace, and everybody should be in the militia. And B, it ain't going to happen that way. It never has. It's 45 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Should old acquaintance be forgot and never brought to mind?
And Happy New Year, my friends.
Should old acquaintance be forgot and days of old lifetime?
Ed, welcome back. Hope you have a safe and happy holiday season. Special thanks this week so much to my producer, David Poole, to Louise Hartman, to Alex Goldmark, and Dan Jacobs at Air America New York, putting this show together, to Ben and Shelby at WhiteRoseSociety.org and RadioPower.org, streaming the program, to Sue Nethercutt and our folks in our chat room, Mike Toth, who does our audio archives on our website, and to our affiliates, our sponsors, and to you for listening to our program. Thank you. Thank you so much. A quote for the day here. This, you could say it applies to this year. It's actually a bit of an old quote. United States Congressman from Texas, Tom DeLay. Quote, "This nation sits at a crossroads. One direction points to the higher road of the rule of law. Sometimes hard, sometimes unpleasant, this path relies on truth, justice, and the rigorous application of the principle that no man is above the law." Keep in mind, he was speaking about the impeachment of Bill Clinton. "Now the other road is the path of least resistance. This is where we start making exceptions to our laws based on poll numbers and spin control. This is when we pitch the law completely overboard when the mood fits us, when we ignore the facts in order to cover up the truth. No man," said Tom DeLay, "is above the law. And no man is below the law. That's the principle that we all hold very dear in this country." So I suppose our quote for the day, although we can always go back to Bushisms.
I hear there's rumors on the internets that we're going to have a draft. We're not going to have a draft, period.
Yeah, we're definitely not going to have a draft, period. You get that? Okay, good. Yeah, we won't have a draft. Why won't we have a draft? Because if we had a draft, you'd have to pull out of Iraq. Families wouldn't put up with it. BJ in University Place, Washington on the line. Hey, BJ, welcome to the program.
Hey, afternoon. They just made the announcement that they're investigating the leaks, the wiretapping leaks, and I think a prediction for 2006 is three fronts Bush is going to get nailed on this.
Well,
first of all,
let's just clarify. The announcement that was made by the Justice Department is that they are going to try to hunt down and prosecute the person who revealed the fact that Bush is illegally spying on us.
Yeah, that's going to be my point. The first thing is he's going to get nailed for illegal wiretapping. Second thing, the investigation is going to come back and show that it was somebody within his administration that leaked the information. And thirdly, is they're going to pressure the New York Times to give up their sources. And once again, that's going to put them in that predicament. The same thing with the previous leak investigation. They're going to have to judge, and they're going to throw someone in jail, and it's going to put him on the wrong side of that as well. And I think he's in big trouble on this one. And I think that's why he kind of stalled on investigating this leak at first, and I think he doesn't have his ducks in a row, and it's going to hurt them, and especially the elections in 2006.
Well, from your lips to God's ears, BJ, let's hope that that's the case and that that's how it works out. I don't know. I think it's particularly bizarre that the Justice Department is now going after the leaker rather than going after the guy who's illegally bugging us. But in any case, our song, I realize it came out 2 months before the beginning of this last year, but my song for the year, this is so well said by the Honky Tonkers for Truth here.
And I'm taking my country back. Son, you ain't been doing her right. Oh, I've been watching you and I don't like how you've been treating my stars and stripes. You took our jobs and sent them overseas. Now we owe billions to the red Chinese. You blew the budget and you bossed Iraq. So I'm taking my country back.
Yes, indeed. The Honky Talkers for Truth, and that is Joe Stampley. Joe Stampley was his father. I'm missing it. Anyhow, it's Mr. Stampley singing that song, and he continues with this. And this is just such a cool song. This is just so cool. He continues.
We had a bundle in the treasury drawer, more than there had ever been before. But every day we're down in deeper in debt. Maybe 4 years should be all you get. Then you gave tax breaks to the millionaires, and you tried to make the working man pay. But you can't tax a man when his job's not there. Now look at where we are today. Hey, I'm taking my country back. Son, you ain't been doing her.
There you go. It's Tony Stampley. Thanks to the folks in the chat room. Tony Stampley and the Honky Talkers for Truth.
Stars and stripes. Got too many fancy friends for me. The Saudis treat you like you're royalty. You blew the budget and you bossed Iraq. Now I'm taking my country back. Now I can understand why you were hot. Cause Bin Laden never did get caught. So you said we had Saddam to blame. Tried to tell us it was all the same. But now the years roll by and our kids keep dying. You don't even have a plan to bring them home. And those WMD you promised on TV, hey, admit it, you figured it wrong. So I'm taking my country back.
There you go, my friends. Yeah, we got to be taking our country back. I'm telling you, get out there, get political, get active. Go to democracyforamerica.com, join up. Go to democrats.com, democrats.org for the party.
You don't know my name, but you know who I am. I'm your everyday work hard, play hard, raise kids and pray hard, common man. And Lord knows I love this land.
That's, we've all got to be working on it. This has got to be our resolution for the year, you know? You have the power.
You've been treating my stars as stripes. Saying that, but you love us more. Seeing each other on the same floor. Are they supposed to be above all that? I'm taking my country back. I've got my family and my church and flag. I'm taking my country back.
There you go. Indeed.